for today is Sullivan v. Running Waters Irrigation, appeal number 13-1308. Mr. Doherty.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Brian Doherty for Running Waters Irrigation, Inc. and JV Equipment Leasing, LLC. This case presents the issue of whether successor liability can lie when there is a piecemeal asset sale from one company to the other, here from Alpine to JV, and whether leasing that equipment from JV to Running Waters also could result in successor liability. Based on my research, this is the first opportunity I believe this Court has had post-Teed versus Thomas & Betts Power Solutions to consider this issue. Successor liability is an equitable doctrine, and one of the maxims of equity is that equity follows the law. The law in this circuit has always been that successor liability is predicated on there being a substantial asset sale, because in those circumstances, the purchaser would continue the operations of the predecessor. It's also important because notice comes into play, because a buyer of those assets can take the liabilities into consideration.
Is there any doubt here that Jeff, the son, knew about these liabilities? He had been the 100% shareholder of Alpine when these liabilities were being litigated, right?
Well, he was not a 100% shareholder. That was incorrect on the 2008 federal income tax returns, which he did not sign. He never adopted those statements as his own, and he also provided an affidavit during the pendency of this case indicating that he was never a shareholder of the company. Now, I believe Alpine...
How on earth does he wind up being designated as the sole shareholder by his father in the company's tax returns?
I wish I knew, Your Honor. That question never came out in the district court level. It was an error, and Alpine, I believe, was a C corporation, and so he did not receive any type of tax benefits by being incorrectly named as a shareholder.
Could I ask you, Mr. Doherty, does your position in this case depend upon, in essence, looking at JV and Running Waters as two separate entities?
It does, Your Honor.
So if they were united as one entity, the question of successor liability would be pretty clear here, wouldn't it?
If they were one entity and the same thing happened, I still don't believe
it. So that you had one entity that had all of the assets that were sold, those that were unsold apparently were at Jeff's house. You had almost all the employees, the customers, same businesses. All those combined in one entity, that would be a pretty clear case for successor liability, right?
No, it would not, because less than all of the assets were purchased. In fact, only six pieces of equipment were purchased, three motor vehicles, two trailers, and a vehicle called a Vermeer, which is a trencher.
Is it correct that all of the assets that were not purchased by JV were at Jeff's home, where the business was run?
Alpine was operating from Jeffrey Zay's residence, and there are multiple barns out there. The equipment that was abandoned was...
Abandoned at his home.
Abandoned at the barns on the property that he owns, correct.
Okay. Were these assets surplus to the business, or were they old and decrepit, or...
Why were they abandoned? They were old, and a lot of them were equipment that were specific to irrigation installation, such as rototiller, tamper, surveyor, tractors. When Jeff started Running Waters, he was going into the service end of the irrigation business, meaning that he wasn't going to be doing any type of installation work going forward. Now, the record is clear that initially he did do some installation work. In 2009, there were approximately 12 jobs that were installation that netted $68,000. In 2010, there were four jobs that netted $21,000. This is in contrast to the service end of the business. In 2009, revenues for service work were $116,000. And in 2010, it was $217,000. So there's a substantial difference in the type of work that he did.
And this accounts for the division of assets.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
I say that accounts for the division of assets, the abandonment of assets.
Correct. That explains why he was going into service work as opposed to irrigation work. He couldn't really go into irrigation work going forward because he was a fledgling business. He had very little, if at all, no capital. And in order to do irrigation work, he would need to get bonds and insurance, something that he could not afford as a fledgling operation. He would also need a plumbing license in order to do irrigation work. And he did not maintain his plumbing license as well going forward. You need a license for plumbing for this type of operation because you need to hook up the irrigation system to a water source, and that requires a license. Here, piecemeal equipment sales do not result in successor liability in this circuit. This court stated as much in EEOC versus Vucetek, where the court reasoned maintaining the fluidity of corporate assets is impeded if assets sold piecemeal are each encumbered by the liabilities of their previous owner, at page 945.
Mr. Dardy, I wonder if I could switch the focus just a little bit. First of all, a very basic question. Do you challenge the use of Rule 25C to determine the successorship liability question in ERISA, in the ERISA context? Do you, as a general proposition, do you challenge that?
I challenge it if you do not get an evidentiary hearing on the issues in order to determine if one is a successor.
Now, if there had been an evidentiary hearing, what issues of fact would you have tried?
The issues of fact would be what assets were actually purchased by JV, what assets were not purchased and or abandoned by Alpine. That would be the biggest issue. And whether there was any type of continuity going forward with running waters, that would be the other issue.
In the same vein, the magistrate judge, in making his recommendation to the district court, referred to the demeanor and evasiveness of your client. And apparently did this on the cold record of the deposition. Am I correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Now, to what degree did that determination affect the magistrate judge's findings of fact? And more importantly, to what degree did it affect the findings of fact of the district court who reviewed the R&R? And those are the findings of fact that, of course, you're stuck with here.
Correct. I believe what occurred by the magistrate judge is that any inference, any reasonable inference that could be construed in favor of the defendants was in fact construed against them without any ability to assess their credibility at a hearing. For instance, Robert Zay was a rather elderly individual. He was having hard of hearing at the depositions. I sat with him at the deposition. There was various instances where he kept saying, "Pardon me," at various times. His highest level of education was high school. This was not a sophisticated business individual. This was an individual that started a company back in 1965 as a small irrigation company. The same is true with Jeffrey Zay, his highest level of education, high school education, his formal training as a plumber, and again, these individuals were not noticed for depositions under Rule 30B6. They were not required to show up to be educated on various topics. They came to these depositions and gave the best answers they could under those circumstances. So,
are you suggesting that somebody in plaintiff's position should issue a 30B6 deposition notice rather than just deposing the two people who had owned the company?
Well, in this situation, given that the magistrate judge found there to be evasiveness in the answers, it definitely turned out to be a disadvantage to my clients in this case because they were not able to fully answer very specific questions on corporate law and other dealings within the company.
Mr. Doherty, if I could follow up on Judge Ripple's questions a little bit. where in the record did you ask for an evidentiary hearing on the 25C motion?
We raised the issue of not being heard in an evidentiary matter at least four times in briefs that we wrote to the court. We never specifically came out and filed a motion seeking a hearing, being under the impression that a case would get disposed of in this matter by a hearing and not based on a paper record. But our objections were duly noted at least four times in briefs we filed with the magistrate and with the district court.
Those are cited in your reply brief?
Those are cited in the reply brief.
And what evidence were you unable to present?
Unable to explain why Jeffrey Zay did not want to purchase Alpine. He declined to purchase Alpine. And
what evidence were you unable to present?
His testimony, his explanation as to what his business actually was going forward.
Did he submit an affidavit?
No, I didn't have the burden of proof in this matter, and based on the evidence that was already existing in the record, it was clear that this was not a substantial asset purchase, which is a predicate to successor liability.
Obviously, the magistrate judge and the district court disagreed with that for reasons that, frankly, are pretty understandable. But I'm trying to understand what was he unable to testify about? That he was asked a lot of questions in his deposition.
I guess it's pretty much not being able to present a coherent story as to why you purchased this equipment and what you did going forward. The record in this case was not very clear as to the difference between irrigation installation and irrigation service. And had he been allowed to testify, he could have explained a lot of the details as to why there's a difference being an irrigation service company versus being an irrigation installation company, and it would explain why assets were purchased and was.
Wasn't there also a question as to the role he played in Alpine?
He was an employee at Alpine.
That's what he says.
Correct, and that's not been disputed anywhere by any other evidence. I mean, he supplied an affidavit indicating that he was not an owner. He was working in the field with the crew. He was not working in the office, bidding work, paying the bills, making the contributions.
Have the district court characterized his participation in Alpine?
Well, the district court relied on a statement that said he was in charge of the quote-unquote day-to-day operations.
What statement was that? Who made that statement?
I believe it was one of the depositions.
Whose deposition?
I believe it might have been Robert. I think it was maybe Jeff Zay's deposition when the question
Whose
was asked.
Whose deposition?
Jeff Zay, Your Honor. Jeffrey Zay.
Your client.
Correct, Your Honor.
So a lot of this, to what degree did his demeanor affect the magistrate judge's estimation of what role he actually played? Or did demeanor have any effect?
I believe his demeanor did have an effect because it was cited by the magistrate judge and adopted by the district court. If that phrase, now looking back, that phrase has a lot of importance, and had we known it at the time, we could have gone back and elaborated on what his specific duties were when he worked at Alpine. I'd like to reserve any time after rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Doherty. For plaintiffs, Mr. Marco.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Frank Marco, and I represent the appellees. The issue before the Court is whether or not the District Court abused her discretion in entering judgment against the appellants. As I have parsed through the record, I recognize approximately five arguments that counsel is making as to why the District Court abused her discretion. The first argument is that they set up two companies rather than one. I think Your Honor's inquiry whether or not if they set up just one company would be more of a straightforward successor liability case where the assets go to that successor company, as do the operations. And that is quite true. But the courts have also found that when you have an intervening lease agreement, it doesn't change the facts. The Artistry Woodworking case, there was a lease from the predecessor to the successor, and then as a result of that lease agreement, they still operated the same equipment. Now, in this case, they set up two companies. One was JV Leasing. That company purchased the assets for about $15,000 or $16,000. And the sole purpose of that company was to lease that equipment back to RWI. They weren't able to, they did not lease that to any other company. And they leased it under a five-year lease agreement for the exact same amount that they purchased it from the predecessor. So this is a court of equity. Council expects you to look at just JV leasing and say they didn't conduct any operations, and therefore they're not a successor. And then on the other side, RWI is just an installation or a service company, and they didn't acquire any equipment. But they're using the same equipment, and a court of equity, particularly under successor liability, that's an equitable test, the court can certainly look at those two entities together and find that together they are successors. That's exactly what the magistrate ruled when he found that the two companies were set up to work hand in hand in order to take over 100% of the operations of Alpine, which is exactly what they did.
Mr. Marco, are you aware of any case in this circuit or indeed in any other circuit where Rule 25C has been used to resolve a successorship issue in the context of ERISA?
I'm aware in the district court there was one case that Artistry Woodworking.
At the Court of Appeals level, throughout the United
States. Court of Appeals, just the Panther Pumps in this circuit. I'm not aware outside of this circuit of any case in which 25C was used in order to establish successor liability. The second argument that counsel raises is that there should not be successor liability in this case because Alpine was unable to provide relief. And in this regard, they're looking at whether or not Alpine could satisfy the judgment. Now, obviously, we wouldn't be here if our judgment could be satisfied by Alpine. Although the case is interesting, it's not that interesting. Plaintiffs frequently pursue these successor liability cases solely because they were unable to satisfy their claim with the predecessor. Counsel's brief argues that somehow the Teed decision that was decided this summer created a sea change, that it called into question whether or not the artistic furniture test was still viable. But nothing could be further from the truth. The artistic furniture case involving successor liability and ERISA matters sets forth a two-part test. And that two-part test is quite simply that the successor must have notice, and there must be substantial continuity in operations between the entities. That is strictly the test. It's been around for 23 years, and it's been upheld by the Seventh Circuit multiple times since that time. And that's always the test whenever ERISA pension fund contributions are in play. Now, the court in Tassimkin analyzed the situation where whether or not the predecessor could provide relief. And that court said it's always a consideration. This is an equitable test. Even if a company meets the test of artistic furniture, if there's some other factor, the court should always consider it. And in the Tassimkin case, the court said that the plaintiff was properly looking for a second chance to get their claim paid, that they were unable to satisfy their claim against the predecessor. But the successor liability case was allowed to go forward because there was the continuity of operations, and there was also notice to the successor organization. The court in that case said that the question of whether or not the predecessor could provide relief was a factor to be considered, but certainly not dispositive. Counsel's argument, which we disagree with, is that they are trying to raise that to the level where it's dispositive. And they're saying that that was set forth in Teed. Now, our view of the Teed decision indicates that Teed involved not an ERISA case, but it involved, an FLSA or it was a wage claim type of case. And that court went through the analysis and said that there's five factors, two of which are the artistic furniture, but the other three tests are whether or not the predecessor could provide relief before the sale, whether they could provide relief after the sale, and whether the successor could provide relief. And for those first two, Judge Posner in the Teed decision found that the predecessor couldn't provide relief either before or after the sale. So there was no ruling that those are dispositive elements because even in the Teed case, the court ruled that those factors did not support successor liability. However, the court found that there was successor liability. And in that case, they found it significant that the two successors didn't pay anything for the ongoing operations, which is exactly the case here. RWI didn't pay any consideration for the operations of Alpine. Alpine operated for approximately 40 years. They built up goodwill. They had client contacts. They had service agreements. And Alpine just stopped operating. Jeff was running the day-to-day operations. And the other company just set up RWI, didn't pay anything for the operations. At one point in the record, it indicates the total value of the company might have been $60,000 or something like that, but they didn't pay anything. But that doesn't prevent successor liability from happening just because you didn't pay any consideration. This is a family business, and we understand how sometimes family businesses get transferred in ways that aren't necessarily arm's-length transactions. But the Court of Appeals can always look at whether or not they took over the operations, which is really the test for successor liability. And there's never been a requirement that you have a whole business part of an asset sale, which may have been the case in Teed, may have been in the case of Tesemkin, but it wasn't in the case in any number of situations, including this one. The question is simply whether or not they took over the operations. And the answer to that is quite obviously that they did. Another argument that
You're
is raised...
They didn't take over the goodwill. Is that right? Is that
they did take over the goodwill because they serviced pretty much the identical customers. The identical customers that were happy with Alpine's work over the years.
They took over the goodwill, but they didn't pay for it. But
that is what we're saying.
That's the argument. All right.
And not paying for it isn't a defense. It just means that you didn't pay for it. You got it free, but you didn't get it necessarily free and clear of any claims, such as successor liability claims, because you are still operating. You're operating as a successor. The next question that they raise is that they weren't provided an evidentiary hearing at the lower court. Now, that is true, but this was all done by motion. And pursuant to the motion, it is up to the district court or the magistrate judge to decide whether or not an evidentiary hearing is necessary. And that's a matter within the sound discretion of the district court or the magistrate. The magistrate and the district court in this case both decided that an evidentiary hearing was not necessary.
But apparently relied on demeanor evidence on a paper record.
They made mention of the demeanor evidence, but I wouldn't say that they relied upon it because there was record evidence, documentary evidence, apart from the demeanor evidence. There was record evidence in the tax returns, for instance, that Jeff was 100% shareholder and an officer of Alpine. So I believe that that's where the magistrate...
So we're being told that's a mistake. How does any judge resolve that?
It's an admission of a party opponent.
It's an admission. It's not necessarily conclusive or irrebuttable.
Correct.
You can present conflicting evidence.
Correct.
So how do we do that without a hearing?
By looking at the other elements that the court considered, because Jeffrey also testified that he was running the day-to-day operations, and it's undisputed that it was being run out of his house. Robert testified that Jeffrey was an officer. Now, they're saying that that's not binding on Jeffrey, but it's certainly binding on Alpine. Alpine's made a couple statements that would indicate that Jeffrey's role in the company was more of a management role and not strictly as a worker in the field.
What concerns me here is that this looks an awful lot like a kind of informal summary judgment procedure without the kinds of protections that parties have through the rules that govern that procedure. And this, to impose liability, I understand your position about successor liability, but at least legally distinct entities that had not been parties before.
Correct.
If we were to let this... I'm sorry, did I interrupt you? Go ahead, sir.
No.
If we were to let this go, would we be in at least tension, if not in conflict, with the Luxliner case in the Third Circuit?
No, I don't believe so, because this is a case where the ultimate question is whether or not successor liability, an ERISA determination of successor, should be made pursuant to motion, pursuant to Rule 25C. And it is granted that it's a shorter procedure than a full trial. It's certainly a shorter procedure than having a whole new case. But the magistrate, when he made the recommendation, put in the finding Seventh Circuit, and I forget which part of this, which case he was quoting from, but he put in there that to hold otherwise could result in a shambles type situation where a case is filed, a judgment's entered, the entity closes up, two new entities stop, set up, take over 100% of the operation, and then rather bringing them in, they say file a new suit. You file the new suit against those two entities. By the time you get through the discovery, by the time you get through summary judgment, by the time you get to trial, you find out that perhaps you win, but you find out that there's two more companies that have cropped up in that interim. The delay tactic that's involved sometimes in these undermines the entire court effort to enforce the judgment. So it's not an easy question, but it really kind of depends on the record of the individual case, whether or not a whole new case should be granted and the motion to substitute denied. That's a matter for the discretion of the district court or the magistrate making recommendations. And the reason why is because there might be some circumstance where they want to produce a whole bunch of evidence that may be relevant, or they want to start subpoenaing third parties, and third parties are holding evidence, which you can't really do in a motion practice type scenario. But in this case, nothing was really presented. All the record evidence that we have talked about here today and that the district court relied upon is all testimony that came from the company. There's no testimony from the plaintiffs. It's all testimony from Robert, from Jeff, and from their corporate records. And that's it. So they had their day in court. They had their due process. Now they want to delay it so that we have to file another lawsuit. And hopefully if we're successful there, hopefully they would still be around at the end of the day. But the reason why this is done by motion practice is because you have a transfer, that something happened. It's one thing if you got a judgment against the company and then you find out that they go out of business a year later and you're unsuccessful and somebody takes over operations. But it's another thing if it's done to short-circuit the court process. And that has to be raised before the district court so they can make an intelligent decision as to whether or not they can use their discretion to either grant the 25C motion or continue it or deny it. And so you have to file a whole new lawsuit.
You could have held a hearing, though, in the context of the Rule 25C motion.
You certainly could.
And here, if the judge wanted to rely on demeanor evidence, it seems like he should have done it.
He mentioned the demeanor evidence. I don't know if I would use the same word, rely upon it, because there was plenty of documentary evidence and admissions of record. He did find a concern that Jeffrey was answering questions like, we don't know where J.D. is located.
That's kind of a harmless error argument, isn't it?
I believe it's more harmless error. It was certainly reviewed. It certainly did appear in the magistrate's report, but I don't believe that was the basis of the decision. And again, if they needed an evidentiary hearing, they certainly had to request it. The case law is strictly clear that if you don't request an evidentiary hearing, you can't bring it up for the first time on appeal.
Didn't they request it in their briefs?
I looked again last night in their objections to the magistrate's finding. The key motions would be the response to the 25C motion that was heard before Magistrate Keyes, and there was not a request for an evidentiary hearing there, and the objection to Magistrate Keyes' findings before Judge Bucklow, and that did not have any reference to or any request for an evidentiary hearing. Those are the orders that ultimately were appealed upon. After the appellants lost before Magistrate Keyes, they could have requested it before Judge Bucklow to preserve their rights, or if they had some evidence that somehow the demeanor evidence was controlling or somehow the court construed some evidence against them that they shouldn't have construed against them and they want to be heard on it, that was not in their brief before Judge Bucklow. And since it's not in the brief, it wasn't preserved, and because it wasn't preserved, it can't be heard on appeal. So I see my time is running up. If there's no further questions, I thank you for your time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Marco. Mr. Doherty, you have a few minutes rebuttal.
Mr. Doherty, in your objections to the magistrate judge's report before Judge Bucklow, did you complain about the fact that the magistrate judge did not give you a hearing?
Yes, we did, Your Honor.
Did you point out to the district court that the magistrate judge had relied on demeanor evidence?
Relying on demeanor evidence, as I stand here right now, I believe we did. In our first part of the objections, there was mention that the first part of the argument about this case being heard on a paper record. So there was mention of the fact that we were concerned that due process rights were being infringed. And even before the magistrate judge, we filed a motion for ruling on procedural objection where we were concerned that judgment was being entered without having a hearing, and we wanted to know what the magistrate judge intended to do, if it was going to issue a report and recommendation or enter a judgment. So in the various briefs, we did, in fact, raise all these
concerns. Did you say anything about the magistrate judge relying upon his demeanor finding?
No, I don't believe.
I think was the essence of the question, though, wasn't it?
Correct.
I mean, you complained that you didn't have a hearing, but that's a little broader question, I think.
Well, it's a broader question, but I think it would also encompass the fact that some of the determinations, the factual determinations, were made based on looking at a paper record, looking at the witness's testimony, and making adverse credibility determinations based on the witnesses being cross-examined at a deposition as opposed to at a trial where their counsel can ask them questions and rehabilitate them.
Are you in a position, Mr. Dougherty, to quote for us the clearest demand you made for an evidentiary hearing?
I believe it would be in our response it would be the objections to the magistrate judge's motion, objection to the magistrate judge's second R&R, and it would be the first part of the argument where we address that. Maybe page 2 or 3 of the brief before we get into the successor liability issue.
Okay. Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you.
Case will be taken under advisement. Thanks to both.